From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Pop Music Obsessions, we meet Nick Hornby. His new novel, High Fidelity, is about a record store owner who defines himself by his top five lists. His top five singles, movies, Elvis Costello songs, and girlfriends who broke up with him. Also, rock critic Robert Palmer resurrects some forgotten treasures of rock and roll history. Palmer was the chief advisor for the 10-part History of Rock and Roll, now airing on PBS. He's the author of the companion book. And guest film critic Steven Weinberg reviews Nadja, the new vampire movie set in contemporary New York City. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Federal Reserve has decided to leave interest rates alone. The central bank's policymakers released a brief statement today indicating they're leaving short-term rates untouched. The federal funds rate, the interest the banks charge each other for overnight loans, remains at 5.75%. Some analysts suggest this is the only rate cut consumers will see this year. The Fed also sets the prime rate. Both of these rates are benchmarks which consumer loans are based on. Congress is sending the president the first of several appropriations bills, and Democrats aren't happy with them. They're calling on President Clinton to reject them. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
The bills total more than $100 billion. They make massive cuts in planned spending for the hiring of new police officers, education, and pollution control. Democratic leader Daschle says his party cannot keep the bills from passing.
We sent a letter to the president urging him to veto these three bills. They're extreme in every way. They devastate families. They devastate workers. They cripple the economy.
Republicans say they're needed to balance the budget. At the same time, House and Senate committees are working on plans to cut planned spending on Medicare by an amount roughly equal to the size of a tax cut favored by most Republicans. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Meanwhile, the Senate is opening debate on the appropriations bill for the Environmental Protection Agency. Gene Dillard reports the EPA administrator is in New Jersey today expressing concern about proposed budget cuts.
Carol Browner stood on the site of an old steel mill, which is now designated as a Superfund hazardous waste site, to issue a warning that congressional cuts in funding would seriously jeopardize cleanups of 300 contaminated landfills, abandoned factories, and sewage disposal sites around the country. The EPA administrator charges the Republican plan would also mean a lower level of environmental protection generally than the American people are used to.
The House Republicans propose a 34% cut, the Senate Republicans a 23% cut. And in the way of Washington, inevitably we will move to split the difference. And that may be the way of Washington, but let me tell you, it is the American people who will lose.
President Clinton has threatened to veto if those cuts remain in the appropriations bill. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard reporting.
There's still some momentum toward peace in the Balkans. The United States has succeeded in pulling warring Bosnian factions to the table in New York at the United Nations. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is urging them to seize the moment and agree on a ceasefire in the nearly four-year-old civil war. There had been a question up to the last minute whether the meeting would actually take place. The Bosnian foreign minister had renewed his threat not to attend, citing new Serbian demands. But in the end, officials for all sides showed up. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 9 points at 4,760. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The prosecution in the O.J. Simpson double murder trial has begun its closing arguments by confronting the problem of Mark Furman. Prosecutor Marcia Clark says it would be a tragedy if O.J. Simpson were acquitted just because Detective Mark Furman is a racist and lied on the witness stand.
He lied when he testified here in this courtroom, saying that he did not use racial epithets in the last 10 years. Yes. Is he a racist? Yes. Is he the worst LAPD has to offer? Yes. Do we wish that this person was never hired by LAPD? Yes. Should LAPD have ever hired him? No. Should such a person be a police officer? No. In fact, do we wish there were no such person on the planet? Yes. But the fact that Mark Furman is a racist and lied about it on the witness stand does not mean that we haven't proven the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Simpson prosecutor Marcia Clark. Federal experts have begun potentially crucial tests in an air crash investigation. Officials hope the tests over New Jersey will give some clue as to what caused last year's fatal U.S. air crash near Pittsburgh. The plane flipped over and nosedived into the ground, killing all 132 people aboard. In the tests, a plane, the Boeing 737, like the one that went down, flies about 4 miles behind a Boeing 727. The lead plane billows smoke, so investigators can track the air turbulence patterns in its wake. Federal authorities say a New York bond trader has been charged with falsifying records in connection with $1 billion in losses for his employer. Daiwa Bank says the executive vice president conducted unauthorized trades over 11 years, causing the massive losses. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nick Hornby's new novel, High Fidelity, is a hilarious portrait of a certain type of pop culture obsessive, a type you may recognize. Heck, it may be you. The main character, Rob Fleming, owns a used record store. He defines himself and everyone he knows by their taste in music, movies, and books. He compulsively draws up top five lists, his top five Elvis Costello songs, top five American films, top five episodes of Cheers. When the book opens, he's drawing up the lists of his all-time top five worst split-ups with women. In a recent review in The New Yorker, Rob Nixon wrote, "It is rare that a book so hilarious is also so sharp about sex and manliness, memory, and music." High Fidelity is Nick Hornby's first novel. His previous book, Fever Pitch, a memoir about his obsession with soccer, was a bestseller in England. Let's start with a reading from High Fidelity that will give you a sense of how Rob, the record store owner, and his employees, Dick and Barry, evaluate people by their taste in pop culture.
A while back, when Dick and Barry and I agreed that what really matters is what you like, not what you are like, Barry proposed the idea of a questionnaire for prospective partners, a 2 or 3 page multiple choice document that covered all the music, film, TV, book bases. It was intended, A, to dispense with awkward conversation, and B, to prevent a chap from leaping into bed with someone who might, at a later date, turn out to have every Julio Iglesias record ever made. It amused us at the time, although Barry, being Barry, went one stage further. He compiled the questionnaire and presented it to some poor woman he was interested in, and she hit him with it. But there was an important and essential truth contained in the idea, and the truth was that these things matter. And it's no good pretending that any relationship has a future if your record collections disagree violently, or if your favorite films wouldn't even speak to each other if they met at a party.
Well, that's the theory of how his relationships work. You know, you have to find somebody whose taste conforms to yours, and taste is everything. Let's hear how this works in practice. I'm going to ask you to skip ahead to page 161, when a friend of the main characters, has met a woman. The problem is this woman doesn't have very good taste in music. Why don't you read it?
"Anna's a Simple Minds fan," Dick confides. "Oh, right. I don't know what to say. This, in our universe, is a staggering piece of information. We hate Simple Minds. They were number one in our top five bands or musicians who will have to be shot come the musical revolution. Michael Bolton, U2, Brian Adams, and, surprise, surprise, Genesis were tucked in behind them. Barry wanted to shoot the Beatles, but I pointed out that someone had already done it. It is as hard for me to understand how he's ended up with a Simple Minds fan as it would be to fathom how he'd paired off with one of the royal family or a member of the Shadow Cabinet. It's not the attraction that baffles, so much as how on earth they got together in the first place."
Well, Nick Hornby, is this an obsession you understand, measuring the whole world by taste?
I understand it. I don't necessarily share it, but I've certainly had my moments, I think.
How obsessed are you with your favorites in books, records, television, movies, and other people's?
I'm always very interested in other people's stuff, and I guess it's something that I want to know fairly quickly. But I don't think I'm alone in this, and I think a lot of men in particular are like that, and they'd rather kind of cut to the chase in conversation and just get people to list things, really.
Do you think that the male aspect is the list aspect, you know, the quantifying aspect, or just the obsession with taste?
I think the quantifying aspect is very important.
Now, I confess I really am baffled when people get together who don't share the same taste. I mean, if somebody, like, is obsessed with movies and starts a relationship with someone who doesn't like to go to the movies, you wonder, are their inner lives compatible?
Yeah, I would say that they probably aren't. I think it probably gets easier as you get older to form relationships and to find points of contact that aren't based on taste. But I think at the times when one is forming relationships, these things are very important.
Pauline Kael, the film critic, once wrote in one of her essays that I think she broke up with someone after they saw West Side Story together because he loved the film and she detested it, and she just couldn't imagine seeing him anymore after that. Have you ever been through something like that?
No, a friend has. Quite recently, they had an argument because a woman described a TV movie as a great film, and you could feel the doubt in his voice, you know, from a very early stage from thereafter, and it really didn't last very long.
Nick Hornby is my guest. His new novel is called High Fidelity. Now, the main character owns a record store. How familiar are you with record store culture?
Well, I've never worked in one, but I guess I've spent a lot of time in them, so I'm pretty familiar.
Why don't you describe the record store that your main character owns, Championship Vinyl?
Well, it's a rather seedy second-hand store for collectors, really. And it sells pretty well all vinyl, I would imagine. They don't have that conversation, but when I imagined it in my head, it's just rackfuls of vinyl. It's pretty empty most of the time. So the three guys who work there spend most of their time arguing with each other. And they don't make a lot of sales. And it sells, I suppose, the pop music canon. You know, if Harold Bloom has a canon, these guys have a canon. And it's kind of R&B, new wave, 60s rock, all the kinds of things that rock critics would approve of, really.
Plus a little ska.
Oh, yeah.
Now, some of the customers in this record store are people who really virtually have no life outside of looking for rare singles. About one customer, the main character thinks, I can't imagine telling him anything of a remotely personal nature, that I had a mother and father, say, or that I'd been to school when I was younger. I reckon he'd just blush and stammer and ask if I'd heard the new Lemonheads album. What made you think of a character like that? Do you find a lot of people like that who seem to have no life and who live in book or record stores?
Yeah, well, it was the thing, I guess, that interested me about people like the characters in the book is that what they listen to all the time is incredibly emotive, and yet they're very anal about stuff. And so there's this great dissonance between the music and its consumers, and it was that sort of area that I wanted to write about.
You know, I find with people who are obsessive about music or books or whatever, that there's the kind of person who just has the list, who just has, well, these are my favorites, I like this, I don't like that. And then there's the person who has just a whole kind of constellation of thoughts surrounding it, and for who those lists represent, a kind of like deep inner life and a rich sensibility. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, sure. I mean, I guess it's the difference between a rock critic and a rock fan a lot of the time. And I think music is a terribly hard thing to write about. And people like Peter Guralnick and Graham Marcus, who are capable of these, I mean, they have very defined tastes, but they are capable of striking sparks and thoughts off their lists, as it were, whereas there's a sort of lumpen rock fan who just can't do anything with a list apart from know that this is the stuff he likes.
Now, where does your character fit into that?
Well, the central character, I think, is emerging from an obsession with pop music. I mean, his 35th birthday takes place during the narrative of the book, and he's beginning to think that it's about time he did something else or thought about something else, but he's not really sure what those things are to think about. So he's kind of in between two camps, really, which is quite an uncomfortable place for him to be.
One of his early girlfriends back in 1973, her top five recording artists were Carly Simon, Carole King, James Taylor, Cat Stevens, and Elton John.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character thinks, I can imagine what sort of person she became, a nice person. Tell me how you chose that list for this early girlfriend.
Well, I guess that was pretty much a composite of the record collections that I saw in girlfriends' bedrooms at the time in the mid-70s. And they were all, one of those artists was always represented in any collection that I saw.
You know, an interesting thing is a lot of times, and I think this is particularly true of boys and men, they want to be the mentor in a relationship. So they'll almost like seek out somebody who's younger or at least more inexperienced or uneducated in something so that they can teach them.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I think it's very representative and very common male behavior. And in the book In High Fidelity, Rob Fleming spends a lot of his time making compilation tapes for women that he meets, and it's, you know, I guess it's like in a way, in a rather unpleasant way, it's like dogs and lampposts, and it's setting your mark in some way, and to that extent virgin ears are very important to that kind of man.
And tell us more about the compilation tapes he makes and how he uses them.
Well, they are a kind of means of seduction. And he meets Laura, who's the other central character in the book, at a club where he's a DJ, and he offers to make her a compilation tape of the music that she's been listening to and dancing to in this club. And so that becomes a very important thing, that he has introduced her to all sorts of things. And then there's an echo of that later on where he meets somebody else and he finds himself making a tape for her too. And Laura sees him and knows exactly what he's doing. But he has very strict rules about compilation tapes, about what kind of music can go next to what kind of music. And he can't have black music and white music together, and you can't have fast stuff and slow stuff together. He has to build all these little bridges between tracks. So he's very finickety about the compilation tapes.
You know, I have to tell you, I've always found that kind of that male urge to mentor a girlfriend kind of irritating.
Yeah, I should think it is, actually.
Yeah, it's like somebody who doesn't want an equal, so someone who doesn't want somebody they can share an interest with, but they want to be able to, like, teach it.
Yeah, and it, really, you're trying to turn the other person into a female version of yourself, which kind of defeats the point of the relationship.
Exactly. Really. Right. Nick Hornby is my guest. He's the author of the new novel, High Fidelity. Let's take a break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nick Hornby, and his new novel, High Fidelity, is about somebody who owns a used record store and is just totally obsessed with pop culture, with records and books and movies and television, and is constantly drawing up top five lists about all of the above. Now, what about your top five singles of all time? Do you have such a list?
I guess the permanent number one is Marvin Gaye, Let's Get It On, which I think is the greatest piece of pop music ever made. And then the four after that change periodically, but there's always something like Hey Jude in there. And I have a residual fondness for Maggie May by Rod Stewart. So that those three are always there or thereabouts.
Do people expect that your top three will be more obscure than that?
Yeah, but I think I've gone through the obscure stage now. In fact, the records that you tend to end up listening to when you've been listening to pop music for 20 years are the great ones, and the great ones tend to be the famous ones.
Now, your main character not only divides pop culture into top five lists, he divides up his life that way, too. And the book starts with My Desert Island All-Time Top Five Most Memorable Split-Ups in Chronological Order. And then the list are the five women who or girls who left him during his formative years. Did you ever find yourself doing that in real life? Or is this just an extreme you invented for your character?
This is something I invented for the character, yeah. Now, I tend to try and forget as quickly as possible. But I think it's something that he would do, and it's another difference between him and me.
Now, when you were writing this book, did you have to do any research, so to speak? Did you hang out at a record store or observe certain people who you thought were really close to the character that you created for your book? Or did you just already know all this stuff inside out?
I think, really, I knew the stuff inside out. There's some stuff about women's underwear in there.
I was just going to mention that's a really funny part. I mean, this is a character who is really disappointed because, you know, he finally figures out that women save their best really sexy lingerie for Saturday nights when they expect to actually be sleeping with someone. But then when you actually move in with the woman, there's these kind of like tattered, torn undies all over the radiators hanging up to dry.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that obviously came from bitter experience. But but I did check it out with a lot of women friends. And so that was my one piece of research, was to ask women about their underwear.
And did they concur that was true?
Yeah, they did, yeah. I'm getting a nod here from the studio as well.
This is your that was your engineer.
Yeah, that's right.
In England,
yeah.
Nodding.
Yeah.
So how big is your record collection? I'll move the subject off of underwear for a moment.
I guess I have 700 or 800 vinyl albums and a few hundred CDs and quite a few tapes as well. So I've got to the stage when I have most things I want, really.
That's actually pretty modest by collecting standards.
Yeah, I'm not really a collector, and I have ditched loads of stuff as I've got older, which Rob Fleming, the guy in the book, would never do. I mean, he'd never get rid of anything, and because he uses his records as a kind of autobiography, whereas I practiced a sort of Stalinist rewriting of history.
So, what do you mean?
Well, so, you know, you sell all the dodgy heavy metal albums, that all the Black Sabbath records that I bought when I was 16 are now no longer to be found in my record collection.
Did you ever have to divide up a record collection after living with somebody for an amount of time?
No, I've always kept things very separate.
Now, how do you keep your record collection? Just alphabetized, straightforwardly?
Alphabetized, but with the first names first, so Bob Dylan would be under B.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I've always had a problem. I've always found this problem with certain artist groups, like you know, like the Jay Giles Band. If you walk into a record store, you never know whether to go to J or G, and it's firmly under J in my collection. I think it makes sense.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess this answers the Sun Ra question. I mean, that would
absolutely
help you deal
yeah.
with that.
Sun Ra, there's a band that used to be here called Danny Wilson, and everyone in a record store thought that Danny Wilson was a solo artist, so they always put their records under W. But it was actually from the Frank Sinatra film,
right.
Danny Wilson. So, again, you see, that's the kind of little problem that this clears up, and I recommend it to all your listeners.
Have you ever wanted to call a moratorium on taste? So that no, for a day, nobody would have any taste. and you wouldn't be thinking, well, what do they really like and what does that say about them? And what do I really like and what does that say about me?
Yeah, I think it is a terribly burdensome thing. But those habits are so deeply ingrained that it's, I think, very hard not to judge. But it would be nice, yes. John Lennon should sing a song about it. But imagine, imagine there's no Quentin Tarantino. Yeah. It's easy if you try.
Your main character in your novel works in a record store, then owns a record store. A lot of people, particularly like writers, musicians, often work in book or record stores before being able to make a living as a performer or a writer. You apparently didn't go that route, but what kind of jobs did you have before you actually were able to make a living as a writer?
Well, I was a teacher for some years, and later on, as I started to write a bit more, I was a part-time teacher. And then I got a job working for a very large Korean multinational company as a kind of dog's body.
Excuse me, a what?
An English expression, a dog's body, where, you know, you just do what they tell you to do. But anything where it was easier to be English than to be Korean, then I did the job. So I did a lot of letter writing and some speech writing and shopping and arranging and all kinds of things like that. I was actually paid very well and I didn't have to work very many hours, so it was an ideal job. That was the last job I had before I became a full-time writer.
Now, did you know then you wanted to write?
I'd always wanted to write since I was about 16 or 17. I guess like most people do, and also like most people, I actually didn't do a thing about it. Each new job that I got, I just thought, well, I'm going to be a writer someday. And then it occurred to me that I actually had to sit down and do some stuff if that was ever going to happen. So it took me a long time before I sat down and did it. But I'd known for a long time that I wanted to.
Well, Nick Hornby, I'd like to end with one of your favorite records. You want to choose a record to end with? It could be your favorite single of all time or something else.
Well, I think I'd choose the favourite single of all time. I'd like to hear Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye.
And defend your choice.
Because it's sort of 3.5 minutes long, which is the length that pop music should be. It has more voices than just about any other record since the Hallelujah Chorus, and they're all Marvin Gaye's voice, which is a beautiful voice. And it's a very sexy record as well.
I want to thank you a whole lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nick Hornby is the author of the new novel, High Fidelity. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, challenging the official history of rock and roll. We talk with Robert Palmer, chief consultant to the PBS series on the history of rock and roll. Also, a review of the new vampire movie, Nadja.
So good, so good, I got a year. Oh, I feel nice, a sugar and spice. I feel nice, a sugar and spice. Do no wrong, and when I hold you. love won't do you no harm. And I feel nice, that sugar is mine. I feel nice, that sugar is mine. So nice, so nice, I got you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of Americans are spending their evenings this week watching clips of the young Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, the Beatles, Aretha, James Brown, and other music greats. PBS is presenting its 10-part series on the history of rock and roll. It features great archival footage and interviews with performers as well as important behind-the-scenes figures. My guest, Robert Palmer, is the chief consultant to the series and author of the companion book, Rock and Roll, An Unruly History. He was the New York Times' first full-time rock critic. I asked Palmer if he wanted to challenge any aspects of rock and roll's official history.
Well, when it comes to television and documentaries about rock and roll, it seems like almost all of them have been parades of stars and hit records. And for every record that we know and every artist that we know and love, there are all these other people that had a really tremendously important input. There's studio musicians, there's record producers, there's recording engineers. In the case of some place like Motown, there were dance instructors, there was the Charm School. All these people that were involved in these aspects, you know, they're really a part of the rock and roll story, and that's one aspect that we really did go after in this series, is to try to get you behind the scenes and show you how collaborations have produced most of what we think of as being rock and roll.
I'd like to ask you to choose a record that you would like to redeem, a record that you think hasn't been given the respect it deserves or hasn't been, you know, noticed in the way that it should have been.
Well, in the area of historical sort of, you know, 50s period, early 60s, in that classic period, one guy that's badly in need of redemption is Ike Turner. Ike Turner is famous these days for abusing Tina, and that's about it. And he really was a key player in the beginnings of rock and roll. He was an influential disc jockey in the South. He was one of the early rhythm and blues record producers. He produced all these great records by B.B. King and Howlin' Wolf, and recorded all these people for little independent labels, often out of his home in Clarksdale. This was in the early 50s. And then he started his band, the Kings of Rhythm, out of the Mississippi Delta, and they moved to St. Louis. And before he took on Tina, they had made some absolutely incredible records that featured Ike Turner's guitar playing, and he was the first really crazed sonic rock and roll guitar player, I think. He was the guy that discovered that you could really torture a guitar with a whammy bar and break and shatter all the notes, and it just, he made some amazing records and has not at all gotten his due. That's why on one of the several top tens I included at the end of the book, the companion book to the series, there's a Rhino CD called I Like Ike, The Best of Ike Turner, and I would recommend that to anybody that likes hot guitar solos and good electric blues-based rock and roll.
Well, let me ask you to choose an Ike Turner recording that you'd like us to play.
Let's see. There's a on that CD, there's one really funny cut on it called Taking Back My Name, in which Ike takes what the Rolling Stones copied from him and takes it back and copies them and outdoes the Rolling Stones on their own stylistic turf. That's a pretty amazing track to me.
Let's hear it. that's Ike Turner, and my guest is Robert Palmer. He was the chief consultant to the PBS Rock and Roll History Series that's currently being shown, and he also wrote the companion book, Rock and Roll, An Unruly History. Robert, let me ask you to redeem somebody else for us.
Well, there's a vocal group called the Five Royales that has somehow sunk without a trace, even among vocal group fanatics. And yet, during the 50s and into the early 60s, the Five Royales were probably the most influential rhythm and blues vocal group on the scene. They had a guitar player and songwriter named Loman Pauling, who, in addition to having been the guitarist who inspired later players like Steve Cropper from Booker T and the MGs, and Mac Rebinek, Dr. John, has always sung the praises of Loman Pauling. And Loman Pauling also happens to be the guy that wrote some songs that I know that everyone's heard. This is dedicated to the one I love, made much more famous by the Shirelles. He wrote a song called Think that was made famous by James Brown and later by Aretha Franklin. He made some amazing records with that group, which was also about the most musicianly of all the 50s vocal groups. Those people could sing. There's a 2-CD Rhino anthology that's, again, on one of my top 10 lists that's called Monkey Hips and Rice, the Five Royales Anthology. And that's on Rhino. And that's an artist who's definitely in need of being reclaimed. I was so happy to be able to find a picture of Loman Pauling getting guitar feedback on stage at the Apollo in the 1950s. And that's in the book.
Let me ask you to choose a Five Royales track that you'd like us to play.
I would play Think.
Good.
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Think about the sacrifices that I made for you. Think of all the time that I spent with you. Think of all the good things that I've done for you.
My guest is Robert Palmer, chief consultant to the PBS series on the history of rock and roll. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Palmer, author of the companion book to the PBS Rock and Roll series. Now, what's the point of rock and roll history where you enter as a listener?
That's the beginning of rock as we know it. I think everybody has their own rock and roll history, you know, that starts with the first music that they heard, and it develops not always in a linear progression, but sometimes going back into history as well as forward, you know. I mean, a lot of people come in at the point of listening to some contemporary artist and then sort of gradually get into discovering the roots, you know, possibly starting with the influences of the person that they first got turned on to. I think everybody has that that magic moment when the music rocked them for the first time.
And what was yours?
Mine would probably be the first Coasters hit record, Searchin' and Youngblood. I remember that coming on when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I had been hearing pre-rock and roll popular music on the radio for a few years prior to that, and I was very interested in music, but I didn't, you know, I wasn't that crazy about what was passing for pop music at the time. And then when I heard Searchin' by the Coasters, and a little after that I heard Ray Charles, and that was the music that really turned me around.
What spoke to you about it?
It's really hard to say. I think it was really the quality of the voices. It was the fact that these black singers, there was all these grit in their voices, and these kind of sounds like they were maybe ripping their vocal cords a little bit when they were singing. And it seemed to convey so much emotion and energy and excitement, you know, just the sound of the voices and the texture of the voices, and the way that the voices blended together had a kind of harmony that was not conventional harmony. It was something else. And it was, after having heard very conventional harmony, you know, all my life, having never heard blues or even any really down-home country and western music, but just kind of having heard that 50s white bread pop, the first time I heard black voices and black rhythms, I was just floored. And I probably never got over it.
Why don't we play the Coasters?
Okay, great. Gonna find her.
Reverend Palmer, you grew up in Arkansas, and near Little Rock, is that?
Yeah, in Little Rock,
actually. Little Rock,
yeah.
Okay. And when you were coming of age, it was still segregated, I guess.
Very much so. I personally integrated, in reverse, all the black rhythm and blues shows that came to the auditorium in Little Rock, starting when I was 15 years old, and that was in 1960. There were no integrated shows in Arkansas, and I was the first white kid to start showing up at all the black shows, and it was such a novelty that nobody thought to stop me, even though I was only 15 years old, and I was going in these places where people were drinking and pulling knives and all sorts of things, you know. But I was able to go in and hear people like Sam Cooke and, you know, Otis Redding, Solomon Burke, all these great, great people. And that really was what got me started in the music, was going to those shows. I really rarely missed one. And, you know, by the time I was college age, there were, several more local white kids going to the shows. But there was only me to begin with. And then when I was in college, I was the only white musician in an otherwise all-black band that played around in almost entirely in black joints. So I had a real sort of involvement in black music and black culture that I really think it was possible because I grew up in Arkansas at that particular time. And all of those developments, I was, you know, right on the cutting edge. I've been around long enough that I was able to be first with all that kind of stuff in town. And consequently, I didn't really ever have much trouble, you know, getting into those shows. It was several years later that I first started going to white rock shows, probably about 1965, before I ever went to a Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, and that was to see the Yardbirds.
No, I grew up in Brooklyn and used to go to see the Murray the K rock and roll shows. Murray the K was a great New York disc jockey. And there'd be a mix of acts, or black acts and white acts sharing the same bill, and lots of black teenagers and white kids in the audience. And I guess there was nothing like that when you were growing up in
Arkansas. Well, that was the great promise of rock and roll, that it was supposed to be like that, you know. And I think that it was small independent labels that were putting out most of the music in the 50s. And, you know, as soon as the sort of major corporate labels could reassert control, it went back to being segregated shows again. I mean, the shows that I saw in Little Rock were shows that were all black acts and were for black people only. And yet, if I had been going to those shows in the mid-50s and seeing a lot of the same artists, and it had been Brooklyn, that would have been billed as a rock and roll show. But below the Mason-Dixon line, it was rhythm and blues and strictly for black people.
You know, one of the dramas of the early days of rock and roll was that, you know, the parents and the PTA groups were afraid of the effect it was going to have on the youth. And, of course, all the rock and roll movies of the 50s and early 60s mm-hmm. really exploit that. You have something interesting in your group that's a kind of much darker version of that, and that is a racial fear about the music. You know, instead of like, oh, rock and roll, our kids are going to learn to do lewd dancing. It's like, oh, rock and roll, black music is going to infect our white children. You reprint a pamphlet that I'd actually like to read. This was from New Orleans?
Yeah, the New Orleans White Citizens Council.
Yeah, the White Supremacist Citizens Council of Greater New Orleans. So it says, stop. Help save the youth of America. Don't buy Negro records. If you don't want to serve Negroes in your place of business, then do not have Negro records on your jukebox or listen to Negro records on the radio. The screaming, idiotic words and savage music of these records are undermining the morals of our white youth in America. Call the advertisers of the radio stations that play this type of music and complain to them. Don't let your children buy or listen to these Negro records. Were you exposed to anything like that in Arkansas?
Yeah, I think that you were aware of that. You know, I did have some trouble with the Citizens Council in Little Rock at one point. I had bricks thrown through my window and attempted to set my parents' house on fire.
Because you went to concerts of black musicians?
Because I went to black concerts, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you have anybody to go with?
Not at first. I made a lot of friends, though. I had a lot of black friends. I sort of totally withdrew from white society in Arkansas for a while there, and I went out. My girlfriends were black. The women that I dated were black from pretty much all through high school and into college.
So rock and roll for you also introduced you to a different culture in America.
Very much so.
Are there any groups or particular records that you really love now that you overlooked in their own time?
Yeah, I think that you always miss a few records, and that's what I find so problematic about top 10 lists. When it's time to make up a top 10 list for the year, for example, I've found in looking over my old top 10 list that maybe half the things on it have really lasted, and half were things that were much more exciting in the context of the time than they are 5 or 10 years later. I think that's natural, and I think that a lot of rock and roll, it is pop music, and it is, supposed to have something to say about the time in which it's made. And, capturing the sort of flavor of the moment and having qualities that are going to last are not necessarily going to be the same thing. When I was a lot younger, I tended to like Flash a lot more, and I tended to be a lot more interested in instrumental playing, in, guitar solos and, saxophones, whatever, rhythm section playing. The older I get, the more I love the human voice, and the more my values in music go toward being about really excellent singing. And that wasn't always the case.
Robert Palmer, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks a lot. It was great to be here.
Robert Palmer is the chief consultant to the PBS series Rock and Roll. He wrote the companion book, Rock and Roll, An Unruly History. This is Ray Charles.
I'll wake up, oh, this morning, and I was filled with despair. All my dreams turned to ashes and gone. As I looked back on my life, it was barren and bare, and without love, I have nothing, I have nothing.
This is Fresh Air. Nadja, written and directed by Michael Almereyda, is a highly unusual vampire movie set in contemporary New York City. Shot in black and white, it's an art house variation on the Dracula story, and it has a very hip cast, including Martin Donovan, known for his roles in Hal Hartley's movies, sometime zine writer Galaxy Craze, Peter Fonda, and David Lynch in a cameo. Guest film critic Steve Weinberg has a review.
The oddball vampire picture Nadja, set in modern-day Manhattan, has a chic downtown aura, but it's weirdly funny, and it doesn't look like any other movie I've ever seen. Its heroine, played by Alina Lewison, says that the streets are haunted by the love children of her father, Count Dracula. They're unrecognizable. They slip through the crowds. In Nadja, the shadow world isn't sealed off in crypts and medieval castles. It lurks beneath the ordinary. So the writer-director, Michael Almereyda, and the photographer, Jim Denault, working in black and white, use a combination of glistening 35mm and pixel vision for the haunting scenes. Pixel vision cross-hatches the screen, creating a veined jigsaw puzzle texture. It suggests a whole realm abuzz with half-seen presences, like the bugs congregating under the grass in David Lynch's Blue Velvet. You can see exactly what drew Lynch to Almereyda. Lynch executive produced Nadja and shows up in one scene as a morgue attendant. Humor swirls off the flat affect like smoke, and the inventive images are often amazing. This is David Lynch's kind of movie. In Nadja, Count Dracula is finally dead, killed off by the obsessive vampire hunter Van Helsing with a stake in the heart. Peter Fonda, white hair cascading down his shoulders, plays Van Helsing as an old, brain-fried hippie. Fonda looks like he's having the time of his life.
Thing is, Jim, he was tired, lost, and he was like Elvis in the end. Drugs, confused, surrounded by zombies. He was just going through the motions. Magic was gone. And he knew it. I mean, he knew. I didn't kill him. He was already dead.
As we hear in this scene, Van Helsing is in the charge of his favorite nephew, Jim, Martin Donovan, who's just bailed him out of jail after decapitating Dracula. But it turns out the line didn't die with the Count. He left twin children, Nadja, who floats through the streets of Manhattan in a black hood and cape, and sickly Edgar, Jared Harris, who wants nothing to do with his blood-sucking sister. She tries to woo him back. As you get older, you come to realize that family is all you really have, she lectures him, as she feeds him her special homemade plasma. It's concocted of shark embryos. Meanwhile, she selects a fresh pair of victims. Jim's wife Lucy, Galaxy Craze, and his half-sister Cassandra, Susie Amos, Edgar's nurse. Almereyda doesn't have Lynch's instincts for pacing or coaching actors, but his images shimmer. When Nadja cremates her father, the ash snakes up around the flame. Jared Harris's pocked face stares back at us, fractured, reflected in a discarded pair of smashed eyeglasses. And Alina Lewison, with her immense forehead and long eyelids, is a great melancholy object for the camera. Nadja sits in cafes, chain-smoking, philosophizing, or else hangs with her slave, Renfield, played by Carl Geary, who looks like an Irish Arlo Guthrie. She's the undead as Eurotrash.
Steve Weinberg writes for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the College of the Holy Cross. The film Nadja is opening gradually around the country. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.